The creature from the Black Lagoon might be the only Universal monster where the producers were already thinking about sequels even before the first movie was made. By 1952, a year before the original creature was even shot, producer William Allen, who came up with the idea, decided to change the ending. In the original ending, the creature is killed, but Allen decided it was better to keep the creature alive, or at the very least, just leave his fate in question, quote, to provide a means of possibly continuing this into sequels, unquote. Allen and Universal were on the right track. Creature was a huge hit, and even before Universal released it, they were already working on the sequel. I'm sitting here today with the star of the sequel, Laurie Nelson, and sci-fi movie historian, archivist, author, Bob Burns. My name is Tom Weaver. And off we go to the Black Lagoon. Laurie, you told me once that Revenge of the Creature was the most fun you'd ever had making a movie, and I was wondering, what was the fun stuff that made you say that?
Well, just the fact that the location was a terrific trip for us.
To Florida.
Going down to Silver Springs and Marineland, Florida. And all of the people that were in it were fun to work with. John Agar, John Bromfield, and all the cast and crew. We had fun. We were able to go underwater, swim underwater. We were able to go in the tank with all the fish. It was just an exciting trip.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, this is pretty obviously stock footage of the Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the first movie, for this one they did take part of the cast to Florida. The actual actors, not just doubles. And this is Florida on this boat, the Rita 2. Obviously, the Rita 1 couldn't be used because that was in Hollywood. Here's stock footage of Mr. Paiva and the alligator from Creature from the Black Lagoon. They actually took the stars to Florida on this one, as Laurie was saying, including, I mean, down to the level of Nestor Paiva, Robert Williams, and John Bromfield, who were on this boat. Now, the first time you used an Aqualung, Laurie, was for the movie Underwater at RKO, which I think was a loan-out from Universal.
Yes, it was. Howard Hughes wanted UI to loan me out to them for the picture Underwater with Jane Russell and Gilbert Roland and Richard Egan.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were doing the film, they had to do underwater scenes with an Aqualung.
They did, not you.
Not me.
Mm-hmm.
But they taught them how to do that because they had a big tank on the... on the RKO lot. And they had a big tank there, and they taught Gilbert Roland, Richard Egan, and Jane Russell how to use the Aqualung. I was not required to use it in that film, but I thought, what a great opportunity for me to learn something exciting like that.
Mm-hmm.
So
the Aqualung being a sort of a newish thing in the 50s. Jacques Cousteau came up with it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked them if I could learn, too, and of course they said yes. So I learned how to use the Aqualung when I was at RKO shooting underwater. Then when I finished that film, which was almost a year later, I came back to Universal, and as it turned out, they cast me in Revenge of the Creature, and I was required to use the Aqualung. They said that I could use a body double if I wanted to for all of the swimming stuff, but I said, well, no, I learned how to do this, so let me do some of the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I wound up doing a lot of the underwater scenes myself.
Right. Now, you've been performing since you were a child, right? How did you get into the business to begin with?
Well, I was born in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I was an only child. And my mother and dad moved up to a little mining town called Torreira, New Mexico, about 60 miles above Santa Fe. He became head superintendent of the mines there. And there were little dancing groups and so forth. I was 3 years old when we moved up there. And so she got me into little dancing classes and dancing groups and recitals when we were up there and in Santa Fe. And then we moved to California when I was 5 years old. And she got me into acting and modeling and photographic modeling and child clothes modeling and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got into the movies through various and sundry ways.
Right. Well, before we get into that, I just want to quickly mention, this is one scene in the movie that was not directed by Jack Arnold. In the original script, all the Black Lagoon stuff is out of the way in 10 pages. They come to the Black Lagoon by 2 or 3 pages in, The guy is already fighting with the creature. By 10 pages in, they've captured him, and the Black Lagoon part of the movie ends. But I guess at some point, after the picture was wrapped, they realized how frantically the movie had started out. There was so much action, and they decided a little bit of a recap of the events of the first movie was in order. So weeks and weeks after the picture wrapped, they wrote a new scene and put it back into production of these three guys talking about the events of the first Creature from the Black Lagoon, directed by Joseph Pevney, who was a Universal director who did a lot of stuff, including Karloff's The Strange Door during that period. I asked Pevney about it, and it was probably 1 or 2 days' work 50 years ago, so he doesn't even remember doing it himself. But Joseph Pevney directed this scene and some other bits and pieces throughout the rest of the movie without credit. So getting into the movies by various and sundry means, I know there were a couple of false starts along the way. You were going to be in, or you auditioned, I think, for King's Row?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I was, I guess I was probably about 10 or 12 years old, and I got an interview over at...
Warner Brothers?
I think it was Warner Brothers, yes. And I got an interview with Arthur Landau, who... wanted me to test for that film.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did a screen test, but unfortunately I looked too young. Cassandra, as a child, had to be a little older, about 16, 17 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But they did a screen test.
And then your first movie was years later. I know you didn't make movies until the 50s, I don't think.
My first movie at Universal was... Ma and Pa Kettle at the Fair.
Uh-huh.
No, it wasn't.
No?
No, it was Bend of the River. I think I did Bend of the River first.
Okay.
And then I did Ma and Pa Kettle at the Fair.
Mm-hmm. How'd you get your foot in the door in Universal to begin with?
Well, all of the dance recitals and the little plays and theater groups and things that I was in all the time I was growing up, by the time I got into high school, my mother decided that it would be better if I just stayed in school and graduated from high school and didn't do anything for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did. And then there was a friend of ours who knew an agent, Milo Frank. And this neighbor insisted that we meet him and talk to him about a possible future career for me. So he was married to Sally Forrest at the time, who was a protege of Ida Lupino.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took me to MGM to see somebody over there about a contract. Well, as it turned out, the person that we were supposed to meet, and I don't remember exactly who it was, decided that... he would like to meet me, but unfortunately that day he was taken to the emergency hospital with an emergency appendectomy. So instead of letting it go, Milo Frank decided that he would take me to Universal. So he set up an appointment at Universal for me.
Mm-hmm.
And they took me to all of the people and introduced me to all of the head brass at Universal. And then they took me up to Sophie Rosenstein, and I had an interview with her.
She was like a drama teacher or something there?
Yes, uh-huh. And she was one of the ones that always had the final say on who they tested, you know, for a contract. That was on a Friday afternoon, and on Monday they called me up and offered me a 7-year contract.
Wow. And you took it,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is a slightly different creature suit than the first movie. Can you talk about the differences?
Yeah, well, the head is different for one thing. It's a little rounder, and you notice the eyes are totally different than the original creature's eyes. I always call these like eggshell eyes, they kind of look like to me. I don't know why they changed the design in the first place. I have a hunch that possibly Tom Hennessy, who played the land creature in this, his head might have been bigger or something, so maybe they had to make it a little bigger. And why they changed the eyes, the only reason I can imagine that is for better vision.
Mm-hmm.
Because Ben had terrible time seeing. He had tunnel vision. He could only see straight ahead, and that was it. He had to work by a flashlight. A guy had to shine a flashlight in his eyes so he knew its direction to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And to go in, you know, and so I think probably they did that because Tom had an awful lot of walking in this film. He has to do around a lot of objects and things. They probably did it for that, but I've always been quizzed about that. I still don't know. I don't have an actual answer, and I have no idea who actually sculpted this head, because Chris Mueller was gone from the studio at that time. Possibly Jack Evan could have even sculpted this. I'm not real sure. He was a good sculptor, so he certainly could have done it. You know?
Right.
So it is slightly changed. The suit is pretty much the same. They kept the suit. And, of course, this is Rico under here doing his marvelous stuff as only he could do.
Right.
And he was, you know, worked really well. But this head was obviously bigger, because with Rico, you can see when he's under the water, bubbles are constantly coming from his head.
Yeah.
Because when he would take the air hose and then get air, a lot of it would go in that cavity on top of the head, because it was so much bigger than his. And a lot of the air, you'd see little bubbles coming out of it once in a while, you know. But it was, it's still a really neat looking creature, though. I mean, I thought he looked really good. It's enough, you know, it's the same guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's just slightly different.
Whoa, Joe, are you all right? Kapoor, go! They gone? Joe, can you hear me? Hey, look, he's coming up. He's bringing the
fire. Get him in.
Hurry up.
They are shooting marbles at him, by the way. I asked him just yesterday, how did they do the bullet effect? He says they had marble guns in the old days. I would assume a marble would hurt almost as much as a bullet.
It could. Well, you can hit guy blank, and that hurts too, actually, you know.
Absolutely.
That was one of the most impressive and most exciting things about being down in Marineland, Florida, was watching Rico Browning do all of those underwater scenes and his underwater photography. I was so impressed with him. I think I was more impressed with him than anything else about the movie. He was really a talented, is a, still a
Absolutely.
Very talented
Magnificent
guy.
Guy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I loved the way he went off camera and took a breath off of the aqualung that was down there, and then come back into the shot and swim past the camera again and everything, and then look through the porthole. And it was just fantastic the way he did it. And he was so graceful in that big, heavy, cumbersome suit. He really moved like a fish.
It's very hard to do, working in a suit like that, especially, you know.
Funnily enough, after Creature from the Black Lagoon, and he did a fabulous job in that, when Universal went to make this movie, he wasn't their first choice for the creature. They wanted an actor, well, or a stuntman, diver, whatever you want to call him, named John Lamb to play the creature, and they made a suit for him, and he couldn't cut it. John Lamb worked on the picture a couple of days. There are probably shots in here of John Lamb as the creature. I don't know where. Nobody's memory is good enough to remember, you know, to point to the creature in any given shot and be able to say, that was me, that's not me, underwater. But John Lamb is in some of the underwater shots, and when he couldn't cut it, when Jack Arnold finally decided that he wasn't giving him the kind of creature performance that Rico Browning did, Rico was hired, and he got the John Lamb head to wear. And John Lamb's head, and obviously the headpiece,
was bigger.
And that's why there are so many bubbles coming up out of the creature's
head. It looked realistic, because
sure
that's
did.
The way fish do, is they expel those bubbles. Was John Lamb an underwater swimmer?
He was an underwater guy, yeah. He had a long career in not only being underwater as an actor in things like Sea Hunt and things like that, but he also became an underwater director on Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and all the water shows back then.
Was the suit modified, or
yes,
were they pretty much the
down,
same size?
They had to cut down the suit a little bit for Rico to take
smaller.
Over the part.
I see.
And that's why you get a little too much air coming out of the top of the head in these scenes. It's because it's a John Lamb head that he's wearing in this movie. Have you ever dived, Bob?
Years ago, I tried it one time. I wanted to be a hard hat diver when I was a kid, a salvage diver, like the suit that John Bromfield had on just a little while ago. And I found I had an inner ear problem. I didn't realize that. I went down about 60 feet, and I had blood coming out of my ear. they said, no, I don't think you'd better dive. You know,
it was the end of your diving
That took
career.
Care of my diving days. So, see, I couldn't have played the creature even if I could have.
All right.
But nobody could swim like Rico. I mean, that side-to-side motion that he invented for this thing, just, I mean, it was so unique. I've never seen a swimming thing that unique. It's wonderful.
So graceful.
Oh, beautiful.
By Neil, that's wonderful.
We got a little bit of movie history coming up here. This scene was shot on Friday, July 30, 1954, Interior Animal Psychology Lab. And Clint Eastwood worked in the morning and early afternoon, making his film debut in Revenge of the Creature. Did you see him around? I know he probably came into Universal just around the time you were leaving, Laurie. Did you see much of him at Universal?
Well, we ran into each other on occasion and would say hi, and everybody met in the commissary at lunchtime. But that was about it. He didn't stay around the other actors too much.
Oh, no?
No.
Mm-hmm. And
so I didn't get to know him too well.
Right. When Eastwood comes up in a minute, he has a scene with John Agar in a lab rat, and it is kind of a silly comic relief scene. As a matter of fact, the music from this scene is comedy music from one of the Francis the Talking Mule movies. But as silly as the scene is, it was almost a little worse in one of the original scripts. After Clint Eastwood complains that one of the rats is missing and speculates that the cat ate it, John Agar hears a rat squeaking and figures out that the sound is coming from out of Eastwood's pocket. And Agar laughs and reaches into Eastwood's pocket and pulls out the rat and hands it to Eastwood, and the script called for Eastwood to be fumbling with it and scared stiff of it. So as silly as this little bit is, it could have been a little bit more of a ignominious debut for Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. And rat number four is sitting inside that cat.
Are you sure you fed them all this morning?
Sure, I always feed them.
At least he does this with some dignity.
Yeah, it's a little bit.
Yeah, not too bad.
How'd he get in here?
So who were your friends at Universal, Laurie? Among the actors and actresses, who were your best friends back then?
Well, I guess Rock Hudson was my best friend. He sort of wound up being my big brother. I was the youngest person under contract at the time. And so everybody over there kind of looked after me. But Rock used to fight all my battles for me.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't too many, but he would help me with that. And then Susan Ball was a good friend of mine. We were very close friends. And Richard Long and Jack Kelly.
Mm-hmm. Richard Long, who married Susan Ball.
Yes, he wound up marrying Richard Long. I had a crush on him, by the way.
On Richard Long?
On Richard Long.
Okay.
Yeah. And we dated a few times, and then I had to go away on a tour. And it was right after Susan Ball had found out that she had cancer, and she was going through chemotherapy and different things. And she was my best friend at Universal. And so I told Richard Long and Jack Kelly to look after her and make sure she was okay while I was gone. And as it turned out, when I came back, they were dating, and then they decided to get married. She had her leg amputated, and she was determined to walk down the aisle, and she got a prosthetic leg, and she walked down the aisle, and they got married.
Wow.
I was at the wedding.
She died not long after that, I think, right?
They weren't married too long before the cancer spread, and she passed away.
And among the other actors of Universal, any other favorites that you can recall?
Well, there were so many contract players at Universal, so you stop me when you've heard enough.
All right.
Julie Adams was a good friend. And,
from the first Creature movie, coincidentally.
Oh, yeah. And she and I, and Rock went on tour together for
Bend of the River.
Mm-hmm. And then Tony Curtis was a good friend, and Lance Fuller. I'm sure a lot of people will remember a lot of these names.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Brett Halsey and Palmer Lee, Greg Palmer,
both from the Creature series.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then there was Maury Blanchard and Mara Corday and
Richard Long
eventually married.
Mm-hmm.
Been in a coma ever since we captured him.
But he's still alive.
They're just about.
Look, Joe, you can't do this to me. Well, I've got every man, woman, and child in the civilized world waiting to meet the Gill Man. The hotels are booked for 50 miles around here. I've got the radio, the TV.
Louis, speeches aren't going to do any good now. We'll put him in the receiving tank. We'll see what happens. Come on, let's get rolling, Mac.
Okay, Joe.
This is Tom Hennessy on the stretcher, hoist being moved around at a little bit of too steep an angle for my comfort, if it were me. He said that the stretcher hoist they used at Marineland was ancient and rickety and noisy, and that the operator actually said to him as they were getting ready to do this scene that he hoped the hoist worked better than it did the last time they used it.
And of course, slide off.
And, of course, that got Hennessy's attention. You know, what do you mean by that? And he said the last time they used this ancient old stretcher hoist, they had a shark or a porpoise or some big fish on it, and the whole thing unraveled and came apart, and the fish fell to the pavement and was probably killed.
Oh,
so that's
goodness.
What they told Tom Hennessy as he was getting ready to do it.
That would have been enough for me not to do it,
yeah,
I'll tell
you. Exactly. And here's
Stuntman.
And here's John Bromfield in the tank. I talked to Rico Browning about this the other day. He said that at Marineland, this was the procedure. This is probably still is the procedure with a big sea animal. If it's stunned or comatose or whatever problem it takes, one of the guys gets in the tank, just as Laurie's character explains in the movie, the guy gets in the tank with it and walks around with it until it's hot, which Rico said is the terminology meaning when it's ready to swim again. And here's, we have here Miss Helen Dobson, Laurie Nelson, as an ichthyologist. Did you even know what the word ichthyology meant in 1954?
Not before I did this movie.
I wouldn't think so. So what was a day at Universal? What was an average, let's say you're not in a movie, what was a day at Universal like when you were there? What was entailed for a young contract actress?
Well, it was like a college for actors. It was very exciting. It was like one big happy family with all of the contract players there. I remember I used to go to the studio early in the morning, and we would go from one class to another. We'd go to the diction classes with Sophie Rosenstein, and then we would go to dance class with Hal Belfer, the choreographer. And then we would have diction classes, and we would go to the screening rooms, and they would screen films for us, and we would critique the films and the performances. And then they also took us out on the studio lot, on the back lot, where they had horses and wranglers there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they would teach everybody how to ride and mount and dismount and running dismount and running mount. And they taught everybody how to ride because they did a lot of Westerns there at Universal during that time.
It sounds like you should have been paying them. It sounds like an awful lot of fun.
Yes.
It was very exciting and very much fun. And as I said, it was just like going to college with a bunch of kids.
Mm-hmm. And John Bromfield, we just saw in the tank. What memories of him?
Well, he was really a nice guy, good actor. And it was the first time I had met him. He was very handsome, and I had a big crush on him.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, he was going with a dancer. What was her
name? Larry Thomas.
Larry Thomas, that's right.
Not a very
that's
pretty
right.
name for a girl, but...
That's right. So I had to give up on that idea.
Uh-huh.
Watch it up there. He's starting to move.
And we're looking here at Tom Hennessy. I have spoken to him. I have never met him. You obviously met him when you made the movie at some point, I would assume, Laurie. You got to talk to him or no?
No, because I never did see the man without his suit on.
Really?
With his creature suit.
Mm-hmm.
So I never really got to know him that well. I never met him outside of the creature suit.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't know that much about him.
One of the things we talk about on another creature commentary is the fact how much the story is like King Kong. If you were to put Creature from the Black Lagoon and Revenge of the Creature end to end, how much like King Kong it is. And there you just saw another King Kong-inspired moment. They don't really play it up in the movie. You have to read the script to know that, this. But it's the fact that the people had the flashbulbs is what set them off.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, the script underlines that the flashbulbs going off are getting him more and more excited, and even as he jumps up, there's another guy with a flashbulb right there, and that's taken right out of the finale of King Kong.
Very much Kong.
Mm-hmm. Have you met Tom Hennessy or seen him
yes.
in recent years?
Yes, I have. I saw him at the 3D festival we had a while back. He showed up.
At the Egyptian.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Showed up there. And
yes, I was there too.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Wasn't
yeah,
that fun?
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. This was one of the better 3D movies, by the way, too. They had learned a lot from the original Creature when they shot this film, and they really had everything tweaked perfectly. And boy, some of this 3D stuff really works well. That's another thing that makes this movie hold up so well.
Because
the stuff really looks good. Everything looks good. They had the top camera people here, and the top crew, I think, doing this film. I mean, this is, you know, they consider this a B movie, but I think they had the A team working on all this, including actors and everything.
Uh-huh.
And it's only a B movie because all horror movies are called B movies for some reason. I don't know, and they shouldn't be. I mean, this must have been an A movie as a lot of movies I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
I think they called them all of the science fiction films B movies in those days.
They did, and that's unfair.
Yeah.
Because they were much better than that, you know. But Tom is a very nice guy, very, very big man, very big guy. And he has very fond memories about the film. He loved doing the film. That was a lot of fun. And I said, I think they modified those eyes so he could see better. Because later on, as he gets out here, he's walking all over the place. He has to knock cars over and all kinds of stuff. So he had to be able to see
right
to do that. So I think that's why. But
actually, we have a little bit of a historic B-movie moment coming up here in a minute. It's Rico Browning in the net in the Marineland tank.
Mm-hmm.
And the two divers, according to Tom Hennessy, the two divers who are introducing him into the main tank at Marineland are Tom Hennessy, who plays the land creature later in the movie, or has already played the land creature in the movie. Now he's playing a diver, and the other diver is John Lamb, who is also the creature in this movie. So what we're seeing here is three of the creatures all on screen at the same time. Laurie, talking about B-movies and science fiction being kind of a ghettoized area back in the 1950s, as opposed to today when the movies cost $200 million and everybody's fighting to be in them, you have told me in the past you weren't really overly anxious to be in a science fiction movie like Revenge of the Creature when they first assigned it to you.
Well, no, I wasn't, and because I had been at Universal since I was 16 years old, and I had done some, you know, nice movies there.
Mm-hmm. With big stars.
Yes, with big stars and so forth, and I had co-starred and had never done bit parts or anything, and I felt like I had a nice little career going for myself. And then when Howard Hughes wanted Universal to loan me out to him to do a movie, it was quite an exciting thing, and they loaned me out to RKO. Universal loaned me out to RKO for my contract salary, which about that time was up to about $250 a week,
mm-hmm.
from $75 a week starting salary.
Oh, wow.
And then, of course, Howard Hughes paid Universal for my services.
Mm-hmm.
And a tremendous amount, I'm sure. But they kept me over at RKO for a long time. By the time everything was said and done and finished, it was at least a year,
mm-hmm.
almost a year, I think. And I went back to Universal, and then during that time, Universal had been sold to Decca Records. And none of the people that I knew who headed up the studio were there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't really know me, and I didn't really know them. And when I got back, they assigned to me,
mm-hmm.
and I was still under contract to Universal, they assigned Revenge of the Creature to me, and Destry also, which I did with Audie Murphy.
Right, Destry first when you got back, and then Revenge of the Creature.
Yes, and then Revenge of the Creature was my swan song at Universal.
Right.
Because I was, you know, I was ready to leave Universal and freelance
mm-hmm.
after that.
Right.
But it was
because
kind
of Revenge of the Creature.
I beg your pardon?
Because of the disappointment of being put into Revenge of the Creature was part of the reason you wanted to leave.
Yes, yes, and I wanted to get out and freelance and see what else I could do.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of a disappointment to be put in a in those days.
Yeah.
In those days, it was sort of a last resort. Most people who had a good career going didn't really want to do science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's different today.
Oh, it's 180 degrees different today.
Yeah.
They're the biggest pictures.
And it was almost like a come down. It was like when you didn't if you were a movie star, you didn't want to do science fiction or television,
uh-huh.
because they were all stepsisters.
Right.
As it turned out, I'm probably best remembered from this picture than almost anything else I did.
Yeah.
It became a cult film, and this series of three was probably one of the most watched and the most remembered.
Science fiction back then?
As in science fiction.
I agree.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Finding you here. Look, I'm not one of those specialists who fails to appreciate the other fellow's field. Although, personally, I think we're over-specialized. Why, it's getting so we have experts who concentrate only on the lower section of a specimen's left ear.
And now this area here, this is actually part of marine land, and that's where tourists would actually watch the goings-on in the big tank.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. And Rico Browning would look through the, from inside the tank, look through the porthole
mm-hmm.
at us while
Ooh,
we're talking. There he is, right there. There's Rico
there
Browning.
He is now.
Why don't you bring it up?
And
yeah,
John,
I understand. Excuse me for interrupting, but I understand that they only did about a year's worth of science, not science fiction, of 3D movies.
I think they started in 52 here. Now, let this is Bob's turn. They started with Vuana Devil around 52?
Around 52, and it went to about 56, and that was it. I mean, they died off.
Was Revenge of the Creature the last 3D movie made?
It was the last one at Universal, for sure. I'm not sure about the other studios.
I think it was the last one.
But it might have
been
the very last one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was darn good. I mean, it's just the 3D just didn't catch on. People didn't like wearing the glasses and stuff. And mainly, the biggest problem with 3D films is they weren't projected right. That was the problem with the projectionist. The films look great, but if the guy didn't tweak the lenses right, because it's a two-projector system they use, it didn't look right, and you didn't get it. But if it worked fine, like at that festival we were at, why, gosh, this thing just looked terrific. It just popped right off the screen at you.
Well, I guess they're really kind of rare now and very popular.
Very much so, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everybody hopes that on DVDs, eventually, they'll start releasing films in 3D, because I think it'd be a...
That would be fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Vuana Devil was the first around 52, and this was the last in 55, and it was the first. This was the first 3D movie in a year when it came out.
That's right.
Yeah, and Universal. I don't know how you don't really know how well any movie does with all the creative accountants at all the different studios, but they put their best face on it. They told the trade papers that they were getting more 3D bookings than 2D bookings. They were putting it out in both versions, and. They made it out to be quite a hit, but I think the proof's in the pudding, the fact they didn't make any more 3D pictures and even made the third creature movie flat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ms. Dobson, what are you doing for dinner tonight?
Well, I haven't thought about it, sir.
John Agar, both of you, I'm sure, knew him. Laurie, obviously, but I'm assuming Bob has met him along the line. Can you talk about him a little bit?
We used to have breakfast with
John
him.
Agar.
Oh, John Agar.
Wonderful guy.
Yeah, he was. He was one of the sweet, sweet people of Hollywood. He was a good actor, too. I don't know if everybody knows, but he was Shirley Temple's first husband.
Mm-hmm.
I guess everybody knows that by now.
Not everybody, I'm sure.
Well, now they do.
Yeah, now they do.
And Bob, what were your experiences with John Agar?
Oh, he was just the sweetest guy in the world. I mean, he seemed to love the business. He loved the people in the business and probably was known as one of the nicest guys, I think, in the business when he worked with people. I mean, he treated everybody wonderfully. Yeah, he didn't have any kind of an ego problem or anything. He just loved doing this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he was... wonderful. And he was a good hero guy. I mean, he had the looks and everything, and he looked great. I mean, you got two guys right here that were really good hero-looking guys, and they were both really good actors, too. And then you got Laurie, so you had a perfect team. That's why this picture, I think, did so well. It's one reason it did so well. Well, you had top actors in it.
Yeah.
You really did. And you need it for a film like this to be believable, for one thing.
Speaking of top actors, here's one.
There's one,
Flippy was the one problem actor on this movie. He wouldn't perform for them. They went in early on and tried to film a Flippy performance without an audience. It just wouldn't cooperate. It wouldn't do it with no audience. And they let a few weeks go by, and they tried it again, and he would not perform. And Universal eventually just had to film one of his public performances. Flippy would not do it for the cameras without
an audience.
There.
He wants an audience. That's it.
Which I think is very funny.
Yeah. He was a big ham.
Yeah.
Sure. Absolutely.
Now, was it Flippy? Is it Flippy in that that photograph that I like so much of you, Laurie? Is it Flippy or one of the other dolphins? Do you remember?
I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you.
But
if there was an audience there, it probably was Flippy.
Okay. So tell us what happened with that shot.
Well, when they had audiences, they would bring the children up and put them on that platform, and they would have them put a fish in their mouth, and then Flippy would, whichever porpoise it was, and they would have him jump up and take the fish out of their mouth.
Right.
And that
jump up like 15 feet or whatever.
10 or 15 feet and gently take that fish out of the mouth.
Right.
And it was a big, big draw, it was a big crowd pleaser, and the kids all loved it. And so when they asked me to do it, you had mentioned were you worried about it or frightened about it, and I said no, because they explained to me that all the kids in the audience had done it.
Uh-huh.
I was always game for things like that. So,
you climbed the ladder and put the fish in your mouth. And
yeah, and it was fun. And he was so gentle, he just jumped right up there and just gently took that fish right out of your mouth.
How smart is the gill man? Well, that's what I'm here to find out. I'm a big fan of John Agar's also. It's funny, he had a really rough patch in his career after he got divorced from Shirley Temple.
Mm-hmm.
He did start drinking, and he did start, had a number of run-ins with the law, speeding ticket-wise.
He did have problems.
Yeah, he even went to jail. He was even on a chain gang, briefly. And you would think that would be the finish to the career of any actor, but I guess he was well-liked enough that Universal decided to give him a break, and he did a terrific job in these Universal movies.
He was really having a hard time in those years, and then he met and married Loretta, and Loretta was just the best thing in the world that ever happened to him.
Absolutely.
What a doll. They were a wonderful pair, and they were so much in love.
Yeah.
She was down on location with us when we did this.
In Florida.
This show down in Florida, yeah. And she did some scenes herself.
Yeah,
she was out on the buoy, and, you know,
did
she was
know
a
Loretta
lovely girl.
Bob?
No, I take it back. I met her one time, but I didn't really know her like I knew John. You know?
Right.
But he was just such a wonderful guy. But he had all cleaned up too. I mean, he never drank anymore or anything. He was, you know, really good. He had emphysema later, unfortunately, later part of his life. Well,
you see him at conventions with the tubes on his nose.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Well,
so
I did the last little film thing he was ever in called the Vampire Hunters Club. That thing, and he was really having trouble breathing. But the guy, he was putting 150%. Even then, no matter what, he did the best he could do, and he did a wonderful job. And great guy. He talked very fondly of being in the films in general. He loved all of them. He thought they were fun. He particularly loved this film. That was a lot. He liked this better than Tarantula. He said it was a lot more fun for him.
Oh, I would
somehow.
Think with the location trip and all.
Yeah.
Sure hate to use this.
Rico told me the other day there is, to the best of his knowledge, what John and Laurie are about to do and go down with the bull prod and try to start training the creature. He said he's never heard of any such thing as an electric bull prod used underwater. He says that's, to the best of his knowledge, that's a fiction made up for this movie.
Well, they all got shocked. Under the water, they're all caught. That's the problem. Especially when the creature grabs Laurie and he's hitting the creature, she would have been yelling louder than the creature, I'll tell you.
Well, it all sounded good anyway.
Right.
And it looked good. It looked great.
How funny you should say that, Bob. That is one of the questions I put to Rico. I said, look, if the guy zaps the creature underwater and he's holding Laurie, would a Laurie get electrified? And he said, well, I can't be sure, but if I was Laurie, I wouldn't try it.
You bet. You bet. Yeah, she'd have been jerking around as much as he would, I'll tell you that. You know, she'd have been getting the whole jolt of it, I think.
Can you talk about being in this tank, Laurie? I know it's Ginger Stanley part of it. I don't know when it's Ginger Stanley and when it's you, but you did go into the tank, correct?
Yes, definitely. I did several scenes in there. Just about the only way I could tell, we were both about the same stature, the same kind of a figure, and the way we moved underwater, so it's kind of hard to tell, but in some scenes I can tell a little bit by the difference in the body.
And what all were you contending with in this tank? I see fish everywhere.
I'm not sure whether that was me or not.
Oh, I don't know. But what the critters in the tank? What did you think of having to be in the tank with those critters?
Well, I was a little skeptical about going in when they first told me I was going to be doing that. But they
because we're talking sharks and
sharks and stingrays and manta rays and
eels,
you know, all of those eels and all those good things. But the Marineland staff reassured us that the all of the creatures were fed every hour. So I accepted that. I was young and naive. I didn't know any better. but they had lots of people around, and they had other people in the tank with us off camera.
Whose job it was
to keep all of the dangerous fish away from us. So we went in and we did what we had to do, and it was fun.
Right. Rico says that's a lightweight chain he's got on his ankle so that it doesn't inhibit his swimming.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell, do you remember it well enough to retell Rico's sea turtle story, Bob?
No, I don't really recall.
Okay, about the only the only trouble Rico had
with
the tank.
Oh, you mean... Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, that's where it started.
I don't think I ever heard that story.
Chewing on his foot.
Yes.
And it took one of the toes off, I believe.
I think it was the heel.
Yeah, they thought it was food. The turtle thought it was food, and he thought, wow, this is some great green food here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just eat it. That right, it was the heel. He took the whole heel off of the foot.
And started swimming away with it.
Yeah, he's taking it off with him. So, yeah, and I think somebody noticed, wait a minute, that's part of the suit.
Well, it was Rico who noticed. He felt something going on with his foot, and he saw this big turtle, loggerhead turtle, he called it, taking the heel away, and they were at the point in the movie where they were down to one suit, and there goes the heel. So he shot up to the surface and yelled that a turtle had the heel of his suit, and he said, Jack Kevan, and everybody else went diving in, and they all started chasing this turtle to get the creature heel back.
Yeah. Oh, I never heard that story. Oh, That's a funny one.
Wow. Those turtles are pretty strong, too, those big ones.
Yeah. What did they have to do, sew it back on? Or?
Yeah, they glued it back. Glued it back on, I'm sure, yeah. He hadn't had a chance to eat it yet.
So. Right.
Well, it didn't taste too good.
No, I'm sure it wouldn't have.
He got it. He didn't think it was that good.
Rico said
probably spit it out pretty soon.
Probably. Yeah. Rico said that Marineland was a kind of a unique operation in 1954. He said that a saltwater aquarium was a rarity back then, where you could see sharks and all the other kind of things they had there. And he said that's what made it such an attraction in 1954. And I heard that they had gone out of business 5 or 6 years ago, but Rico says that he's not sure about that, that it might be on the verge of coming back. So it would be fun to go there.
It would be.
Except that it's in Florida. What is Florida like in the summer, Laurie?
It's hot.
Oh, boy, I'll tell you, it's hot. It's hot and humid and almost unbearable, except that, and we were there for quite some time. You know, we were there for several weeks. But it would have been really unbearable, but we went around, you know, with very little clothes on.
Mm-hmm.
That is, shorts and bathing suits and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that kept us kind of cool. But it was so humid that our shoes mildewed in the closet.
Jesus.
And the bugs were pretty bad.
Ooh,
pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
But beautiful scenery and everything. Mm-hmm. It was a gorgeous place to be.
Right. And when you were out on the river, on the St. John's River in that boat later in the movie, that looks like it had to have been a pleasant day.
It was. It was a lovely day. And when you're out on the water, of course, you're much cooler than when you're in the humidity on land.
Be gentle as a baby.
I suppose.
John Agar said that there were rocks down there with eels hiding in the cracks of the rocks, and every so often they'd stick their heads out and try to get a fish, and everybody knew to stay away from those rocks.
Yes, I remember that.
Don't want to be close. Now, there's a scene here where you see him swimming away from the camera, and you'll actually see a rip in the suit in his right thigh leg there. See it right there? You can barely see it, but there it is.
Oh.
You can actually see it, because this suit got a lot of use. I mean, you can imagine what he had to do in that suit. He probably ran into half the coral down there and everything else, and it's a wonder that the thing wasn't, you know, totally ruined. But and I'm still fascinated by the way that he could move in this suit. In wearing suits, I know how constrictive they can be, and he just made it look so effortless. Totally.
It was wonderful.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It was just amazing.
So graceful.
Yeah, beautifully done.
This movie, when it began production, they couldn't pick a title, and they finally just gave up. And the shooting title, during the shooting, was Sequel to Creature from the Black Lagoon. And then a little bit later, they decided they picked out the title Return of the Creature as they were shooting.
That was very unimaginative.
Yeah, it certainly was. And then some of the other titles that they kicked around before they ended up with Revenge of the Creature were Beware the Creature, Captivity of the Gill Man, Creature in Captivity, The Creature in the Tank... They just get worse.
Kind of like the creature getting tanked.
Uh-huh. Gillman versus Science. The Half-Human Creature.
Oh,
Undersea Monster. Terror of the Deep. Terrifying Creature. These are just terrible.
Yeah.
Strange Terror and New Adventures of the Creature. Those are the titles that they were they had to pick from. They ended up with the best of the batch, but does the creature really get what is the creature getting revenge for here?
I always wondered that myself.
Yeah, not much that I know of. I haven't seen him really get revengeful yet.
No, well, he's more picked on, like most of the Universal monsters. He's more picked on than he's usually just defending himself or trying to get back to his Black Lagoon.
That's all he wants.
I warned you I was going to ask.
He kind of picks on John Bromfield and John Agar because he's got a crush on Helen Dobson.
Mm-hmm. He's smart.
Now, that's another thing that's funny you should bring that up. That's another thing that's laid out in the script that you can't really tell from the movie. We're supposed to get the impression that the creature and John Bromfield have this feud going. In the script, it details that throughout the movie, they give each other these dirty looks in all these situations where they're together, and the script really lays it out, and they even have some references in one version of the script to them being like the Oceanarium announcer even calls them old enemies. So they really establish that the creature hates John Bromfield throughout, so that when he kills John Bromfield at the end, that's the culmination of this big feud. But it really doesn't come across in the movie, I don't think.
No, not at all.
No, it doesn't.
Millions of electric impulses leap from one cell of the brain to another, making our minds and moods.
I warned you I was going to ask this question, Laurie. I think of all your movies I've seen, I think you look the best in this one. What, if you were going to show somebody one of your old movies to show them what you looked like in the 50s, which one would it be?
Well, I think I look good in all of them.
Well, of course you do, but I'm talking about the best.
Well, I think this is one of the ones that I look pretty good in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little bit more mature than the ones when I did Bend of the River and some of the earlier movies at Universal.
Oh, yeah,
where
you were a teenager, sure. Mm-hmm.
I was just a baby then.
Right.
But, yeah, I think this is probably, I look pretty good in this movie.
Beautiful here. Absolutely mm-hmm. beautiful. Because you're still beautiful. Mm-hmm. That's the thing, though. You can do one of these today.
Aw, shucks.
Ben? Ben, did I just call you Ben? Bob, who are we looking at here?
That's
on the
Rico.
Right.
That's
Rico.
Rico
Browning.
It sure is. Putting the blood in that syringe.
Yeah.
That ham. See that? He had to get in that picture.
But he was so young and cute, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's about, I guess he's about 24 here, probably.
Yeah.
And the funny thing,
we're pretty close to the same age.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, I mentioned this on another commentary, but I'll mention it again. Everybody always marvels at how long he was able to hold his breath. He told me that starting around when he was 19, he was a pack or two-pack a day smoker.
Really?
He said he got up to 5 packs a day.
Oh, my
gosh. I don't know how he could do it.
And here's a guy who's famous for being able to hold his breath underwater.
He could hold his breath for almost 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, I've never smoked in my life, and I couldn't even start to do that.
Well, I guess he quit early enough that he was able to get his breath back.
Possibly, mm-hmm. yeah.
Speaking of the female form, Bob, I know that you know, you've heard from, I think it was Chris Muller, that one thought early on that they came up with between Creature and Revenge was that they were going to have a female creature in
right.
this movie.
Yeah, they were at one
what
time.
What did they tell you? And I mispronounced his name, I thought.
Chris Mueller? Yeah, Mueller. At one time, yeah, they had made a prototype creature head that Rico actually tested in the original creature. You didn't see it, but I mean, he tested for it. It was more streamlined. I have one at home, and it's a very streamlined thing. And it almost looks like it could be a feminine thing. And so they were thinking originally to have a female creature with him. You know, that could menace the guys, you know, as well. But then that just never happened for some reason, which I think is probably a good idea. I think just keeping him solitary was better.
That would have been a little bit too
I think so.
Too much complication.
Yeah, yeah. You had too much competition to the men and the women.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been a bad thing.
Right.
So they didn't do it. And it's probably just as well. But it's, I mean, I can see where they probably had that idea, but I think this worked far better.
Mm-hmm. And I guess your ultimate compliment for the creature, Bob, is that you had one of your annual Halloween shows built around the creature. And if
sure
you could
did.
Just briefly explain what your Halloween shows were and what you did creature-wise.
Well, for years we used to do what I call Halloween shows for the kids in the neighborhood, and it just got out of control, and we finally got 4,000 people coming by. It got a little too big. But, the creature being one of my very favorite films, we decided to do The Creature from the Black Lagoon, and we built in my driveway and my backyard at the time 200 feet of interior cave. And had the creature make an appearance in there and scare everybody half to death, which he did. And a friend of mine actually built the creature suit for us from scratch because the original creature suits were gone by then. And we did have the last rubber pull out of Ben Chapman's mold of the head. So we had the head was pretty much original. And we had a great time with it. It was a lot of fun, but that was sort of my homage to the creature films. Because, like I said, the creature films are in my top five, that's for sure, of all the films. Because just something about
sci-fi films.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, mm-hmm. It really is. Something about it, it has such a mood to it. And this 3E stuff right in here really worked, by the way. This stuff here, like where you start with the cameras. I mean, they had got it so clean by then. They knew they'd learned the mistakes from the first one. They knew exactly what not to shoot and how not to. Like, this really works because you see,
yes,
oh, you can really see her behind, you see him here, and you really get the depth here. You really, really do, and it's beautifully done.
Do you have much memorabilia from this movie, Laurie?
Well, I have a lot of photographs, and I have. Quite a few posters and lobby cards from
mm-hmm.
this film.
And when you go to conventions, what do you autograph shows? What do you stock up on? Is it mostly creature?
Well, I take a lot of photographs from this film,
mm-hmm.
but it seems to be pretty even in the way they ask for autographs. I have them in stacks, you know, and from the different movies,
mm-hmm.
and they will pick up whichever ones they want, or they will bring their own. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a mixture of things. Mm-hmm. It's not just the creature films, but it's a lot of the other stuff, too.
How about your Westerns? Do you
Western
fans?
I love the Western ones. Yeah. I did a lot of Westerns while I was at Universal and after as well.
Right. And if you don't mind talking for just for a minute, because it'll mostly be sci-fi fans who are listening to this, after you left Universal and began freelancing, I think one of the very first pictures you did was Day the World Ended, which was also science fiction.
Yes, it was.
And I think I wouldn't be surprised if you were reluctant to
much
do Creature.
Much to my chagrin.
Yeah.
Yes.
And if you were reluctant to do Creature for a big studio like Universal, I'm sure Day the World Ended at a small-time studio was not any great inducement either.
That's right.
But what are some of your memories of making that movie?
Well, after leaving Universal, there was a kind of a lean time there before I really got in the groove to do freelancing
and
get other people to know that I was available to do freelance films then. So there was a little bit of a lean time between leaving Universal and when I was able to get really moving in my career again. And so Roger Corman, I think, because he cast me or asked me to do The Day the World Ended because of the Revenge of the Creature film.
Actually, I think it was the producer, Alex Gordon. He wanted, you in it because you were in Revenge of the Creature, and he wanted Richard Denning in Day the World Ended because he was in the first Creature.
Ah, yes. Okay.
So what was it like working with Corman so early in his career?
Well, he was really a nice guy. He was fun, and he was enjoyable to work with. Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, it was kind of a fun film to do. It was very, very low budget, though. Mm. And we did a lot of the location shots at that restaurant over on Ventura Boulevard. They had a lake
That's
there.
That's where the lake was,
The Sportsman's Lodge.
Yes.
On Ventura Boulevard in Studio City, California.
Yes.
They did some of the location stuff right there.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. It was really funny. It was fun to do, though. It was really fun to do. But I remember the creature in that was a funny-looking creature. Really funny-looking creature.
Yeah, Paul did a wild design on that thing.
With those horns sticking out.
Yep.
And they wiggled like this when he walked. And he had to pick me up at one point.
Oh, boy.
And he wasn't a very big man.
He's a little man.
And the suit was very heavy, and he picked me up, and we both fell over backwards, and I fell on top of
it. I've got a great still I've got to get for you if you don't have it of that. Where you're actually falling.
Oh, I don't
and you,
that.
Oh, I'll get it for you, because you're smiling, and down you go, and he's going down. And I was there the day you shot that sequence.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
We were both laughing.
Oh,
it was so funny.
Because, see, the thing is, Paul had to do, he's looking through the mouth of the creature. Literally, because the day the world, because he's not a tall guy, so his center of gravity's off. So when he picked up Laurie, he had to hold her way up like this to make it look chest high. So he's really up here, and that, I mean, he's a strong guy. He was a very strong man, and then they started laughing. Something kind of happened, and they were giggling, and all of a sudden you single boom, and down they went. You know,
I don't remember. Did he fall on top of me, or did I fall on top?
No,
of him?
No, he fell on top of you then when he hit. Yeah, you know, but his rubber kind of bounced off. You know, but it was very funny. It was really funny. But he was a great guy. But that was the first monster film he had ever been in. I mean, he built the monster plus playing the monster.
They had to stop shooting for a few minutes while everybody finished laughing.
Had to get their composure back because it was very funny. But I have this picture. I have to get that for you. It's very funny. You'll appreciate that because that'll bring all those memories back.
Yeah.
But that film was, you talk about low budget. Good
but
Lord.
You know, one thing I wanted to mention too about that, in later years, I recalled seeing a lot of actors, most of the big actors at one point in time had done a low-budget movie for Roger Corman.
Oh, yeah.
They all were in a Roger Corman film. So that I didn't feel too bad.
No, a lot of it. And you know, and that film, the particular film, Day of the Relent, has become a cult film, too.
Yes, it
has. That is a real cult film.
Oh, yes.
Now, here's the one, when he gets out of the pool here in a minute, he jumps out in a minute, and they had Rico on a great big crane with a well, it's, a, you know, it's like a, I don't know exactly what you want to call it. This isn't the scene, but it is coming up when he actually gets out of the
when he jumps up
the pool and he jumps right into the
retaining
camera.
Wall. Yeah.
Really, in 3D, that really worked, too, because they had the camera looking right down at him, and you couldn't see the cable the way they pulled him up. He's on a pulley, and up he went, and he comes right into the camera, and 3D works really well. Here he comes right now. He should bounce up. Whoa, there he goes, and that was really good. I mean, the 3D was excellent in that.
They did some wonderful camera work.
Oh,
in
they sure did.
In the background on the right, you saw John Agar dive into the tank, I guess supposedly to save John Bromfield. He ad-libbed that. He wasn't supposed to do it. He just did it.
Yeah.
And he didn't know there was a big rock formation right there.
Ooh, ouch. Oh.
And he said he figured it out at the last minute and sort of adjusted his dive and just missed hitting that rock formation. He said it's a good thing he did because, you know, even though they'd been promised that the sharks in the tank were not interested in people, he said if he'd bloodied himself up on that rock...
You don't want to be bleeding in the tank with the
sharks. Suddenly the sharks might take an interest. Here's another scene. The way this is scripted, the little girl falls... And the shot now becomes the little girl lying there and the creature in the background getting closer, closer, bigger, bigger, going to stomp on the kid.
Wow.
And then the mother comes sweeping through and grabs up the kid.
There's another Kong moment.
That's the way it's described in the script, that's exactly out of King Kong. Another... Talk about this,
Bob. Okay, now here's
and
the thing.
And that's Tom Hennessy, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He tips the car. Now watch this. As this car comes down, it creams the camera here. You'll see it. Watch the camera move around here. Wham!
Oh, wow.
I wonder if the cameraman did stand it. Well,
no, I think camera's just locked.
Oh, just,
I doubt
okay.
if he was even there, and
okay.
that's why it moved. Yeah, I wouldn't want to be there if that was similar to me.
Not.
But yeah, it really whammed the camera pretty much.
Where you see the creature walking there is the beach right in front of Marineland
and the motel where we stayed.
is right there too?
Yeah, it's pretty close right there.
And when we see Tom Hennessy again, that's him walking right into the... Right into the Atlantic Ocean.
There he goes, yeah.
And cars overturned. Well, that's a little bit of a stretch. And kills guards, plural. There's a little bit of a stretch, too.
Yeah.
Although guards, they did script the scene where one of the guys who tries to push the creature back into the tank with the pole, the creature impales him and kills him with it. But they didn't film that.
I see.
I like this guy here, this newscaster. Every time we see him throughout the movie, from now on, as the situation gets more tense, he has less and less clothes on.
Yeah.
I'm surprised he takes his jacket off. I'm glad it didn't get too tense.
See him shirtless at the end, yeah. That would not be too good, would it?
Laurie, could you talk a little bit? I know you've got an anecdote about working with Jack Arnold on this movie, the director.
Oh, yes.
How was Jack Arnold to work with?
Talk a little bit about that, right?
Yeah, I would love for you to talk a little about this.
Well, we, we went on location, of course, to Florida for this, and Jack and the second unit had been down in Florida for several weeks, I guess, doing background shots and so forth before
the
actors
came. The main cast and the principal photography, right.
Yeah, the background shots of the... of the scenery and everything, and the boat and all
right,
that.
And a lot of the underwater shots
underwater
were done
shots
first
before the cast came down, and motel we had mentioned the motel earlier. It was right there near the Marineland Studios, and my hairdresser Lillian Burkhart and I came down on the plane together, and we went to the front desk to check in for our rooms, and she said, well, you have two rooms here next to each other with a connecting door, and then Miss Burkhart, you were in another room in another location, and Jack Arnold is in one room and you're in the next room with the connecting door. And we were given instructions that door was to be left open because he had to come back and forth to work on the script, and you had dialogue to work on, et cetera, et cetera. And he needed that room next to yours. And I looked at Lillian, and she looked at me. And I said, Lillian, how would you like to be my roommate?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, no problem at all.
Uh-huh.
So I turned to the lady behind the desk and I said, Lillian is going to move in with me. She's going to be in my room. So would you please switch her room? So that's the way it worked out. And He didn't stop trying to come into the room, though.
Is that right?
No, we locked it, of course, and he would knock on the door, and I would open the door, and he would come in and say that he wanted to just come in and talk and visit, and I'd be sitting there, and he'd reach down and start massaging my feet, and but that only lasted a few days, and then he got the idea that nothing was going to happen, so he just didn't try anymore.
Right, so you threw some cold water on his plans.
Right. But he never knew what happened. He never knew the reason why.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked out very good because it didn't cause any problems with the film.
Yeah.
So it was sort of a happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
Ellen!
Who is it?
Fleet. Where's Chris?
Well, I left him in the bedroom. Isn't he there?
No. I heard him howl.
Well, I'll be right with you.
I'll look for him outside. Chris? Here, boy. Here, Chris. Here, boy. Here, Chris.
You know what's funny? In all these Universal movies, there's always, or almost always, a hand-on-the-shoulder shot. They started that in It Came From Outer Space.
Right.
Audiences jumped out of their seats in one scene where Barbara Rush puts her hand on Richard Carlson's shoulder.
Oh.
And to the point where, at the preview, they wrote on the preview comment cards that, you know, that was one of the big scares of the movie. So that was all Universal at the year. They put it in Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Every one of them.
They put it in. We've seen it twice in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
She just did it to Agar. And in the scene with the teenage couple kissing in the car, the cop's hand reaches in and touches them.
Mm-hmm.
And right down the line, right to the end of the parade with Monster on the Campus, right through the 50s, they always had the hand on the shoulder shot.
Well, they knew it always worked.
And it's just so funny. I mean,
a good scare tactic.
Yeah, well, it's so funny now. With so much gore in movies and so much special effects and gore, that audiences are almost shock-proof. And it's almost weird to look back 50 years where a hand on the shoulder could
make you jump.
Could not only make an audience jump, but when the movie's over, they'd be talking about, remember the scene where they put, and writing on their preview comment cards, remember the scene where they put the hand on the shoulder?
Yeah.
And I guess this was really scary stuff back then.
Yeah.
This is the St. John's River, and actually, here's trivia. All I'm good for is trivia, so I've got...
This is the old creature suit here. It's a shot from the old things.
That's from the first movie.
Yeah,
okay.
No eyes, yes.
Right. This is the St. John's River, and this boat is the very boat that the Marineland specimen hunters used to go out onto the ocean and capture whatever for Marineland.
Okay.
And they got to use it in this movie.
Really?
And here coming up, I think he's about to talk to the sailor on the ship. Or maybe he's not. Never mind that part. Okay. Later in this scene, there's a sailor, and he speaks, if I'm not mistaken, with the voice of John Saxon. John Saxon did do voice work for this movie. I found paperwork at Universal to that effect, but no indication of what character he played. And if you ask me, the sailor on this ship speaks in two different scenes, both times with the voice of John Saxon. Laurie, could you talk about some of the other things you did after Universal and some of the stars you worked with in movies like I Died a Thousand Times and Partners?
Yeah, I did I Died a Thousand Times with Jack Palance and Partners with Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. That was next to the last film that they did together.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you did get your career back on track.
Yes, and then I did a couple of more low-budget films, Hot Rod Girl and Untamed Youth and... Mm-hmm. You know, a few things like that.
Yeah.
And,
also cult pictures today.
Yes.
Untamed Youth, especially with Mamie in it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But I did a lot of freelance films and worked for Warner Brothers and I worked for RKO and Columbia and Paramount.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did a lot of television,
right.
Lots of television, and guest shots on every Western that was on the air at the time, and they were doing a lot of them in those days.
They were.
Yeah, Wagon Train, Gunsmoke, Have Gun Will Travel, Sugarfoot, you name them, I did them.
Uh-huh.
And also, I did the series How to Marry a Millionaire.
Right.
With Barbara Eden, Mary Anders, and I. So I kept busy.
Mm-hmm, you certainly did. tell people what this scene is a remake of, swimming in with the creature underneath.
Oh, it's right out of the original creature, where he's going to come in here in a second, and he swims right under her, and they're kind of reprising the role a little bit.
I think Ginger Stanley did that underwater stuff right there.
Yes, she
and
did.
Then I did the
topside.
That's me right there, the topside stuff.
Right. That's Ginger Stanley and a friend of Rico Browning's named Bob Tinney, who Rico calls Sonny Tinney because they were boys together. He only died about a year ago.
Yeah.
And here you got a...
Yeah, that was Ginger Stanley right there.
Mm-hmm. And Bob Tinney.
Mm-hmm.
This is Silver Spring, by the way. The first movie was all Wakulla Spring, and which is a lot deeper and a lot bigger than Silver Spring, but this movie, to save some money and for convenience, Rico said the underwater scenes of this movie were shot in Silver Spring.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie McNabb, one of Rico Browning's safety guys, he and a friend were the two first people to explore a cave in the bottom of Silver Spring years and years ago, probably even before Revenge of the Creature, and they found prehistoric teeth and tusks and all sorts of stuff from prehistoric animals, and it was written up in Life magazine.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Try to pull my leg, will you?
Huh?
For a professor, you certainly have the manners of a freshman.
Hey, professor! Come on back! It's all fixed!
Fun's over.
Are you enough of a stamina swimmer, Lori, to do all this easily?
Well, right here, yes, but when we were swimming up the long distances, we back to the boat, where there were some scenes where we climbed back up on the boat.
Right.
By the time we got back, John Agar and I were both pretty winded. Neither one of us thought we were going to be able to get back because they took us
quite a ways out.
So, we're just barely getting back with enough breath to get up the ladder. See what I mean?
Yeah. At Silver Spring, I'm sure it's a nice place, but it's just not as deep and not as nice as the lagoon in the first movie. What do you say, Bob?
Yeah, I think the lagoon was better in the first one.
Wakulla Spring was better.
The water was, yeah.
Yeah, because even in the early scene in this movie of John Bromfield fighting the creature underwater, it's just... You could jump out of that boat and hit bottom.
Yeah.
And the first...
Pretty easily, yeah.
The first Black Lagoon movie, you could tell that lagoon was endlessly deep.
Oh, it was pretty deep, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, see, there's from the original film again. That's the one without the eyes. It's the original creature head.
Rico did the swimming in both films, though, didn't
mm-hmm.
he? Did he and do it in all three?
All three.
He
all
plays
three.
The creature also in the third, yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, he's the only one that played the creature all the time, you know. Well, they couldn't get anybody better than him to do the swimming stuff.
This is a... Look at these sniffs. This is like Carnival of Souls, the Dance of the Living Dead here.
Yeah. All right, now dance and act like you're enjoying yourself.
Yeah.
This is a restaurant, a real restaurant in Florida called the Lobster House, and Universal paid $250 a night to...
And none of them are smiling.
No, not a one. They're all y'all scared stiff. They're all extras, Rico told me.
I don't even know this lady I'm dancing with.
Exactly. They're all extras from an insurance company next door. And
were they?
Yeah.
Oh,
they all dressed up in their best came to the Lobster House, and they were shooting there. And they
had stage fright.
It certainly looked like they had stage fright. And then the funny part is that obviously they probably never shot anything in there before Universal, you know, the movie makers put the lights in. Right up close to the ceiling, these hot lights, arc lights.
Oh, boy.
Place had a sprinkler system. And the heat built and built up near the ceiling, and finally the sprinkler system went off. And
little
rust
rain.
Never been used before, installed years before, never used. Rusty water just cascading down on everybody in their
or
best
down
clothes.
Down on everyone, yeah.
Oh.
I wasn't there that night.
Mm-hmm. Or when that...
Thank goodness.
Yeah. Well, you were probably there, but you probably left
That's
before it happened.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I looked it up in the dictionary. And love, according to Mr. Webster...
John Agar recites a poem here, and for some reason he doesn't cite the author, and made me curious, so I'm not much of a computer person, but I Googled the poem, and it came up. The poem was written by Sir John Suckling.
Oh, really?
So I could see why they didn't make it.
You sure you want to go there?
Exactly.
Okay.
And How to Marry a Millionaire, Laurie. What was the week-to-week grind of a TV series like? Did you enjoy it?
Well, yes, it was, but it was very hard. They did series in those days. They would do, we had to learn a whole new half-hour script every weekend for the following week. And then Monday and Tuesday we would rehearse. And then Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday we would shoot.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like 7 days. And we would be up at the studio early in the morning for makeup and hair, like at, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, mm-hmm. and work till 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night,
mm-hmm.
every night.
Wow.
On the 3 days we shot.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite a grind. We did a half-hour script every week.
I got to bust in here just to mention that this music is written by Henry Mancini, one of his first movies, uncredited, 1954, and here we are in 2004, recording this audio commentary in the Henry Mancini building at Universal.
Amazing.
And I want you to direct your attention. There's a clock over the door as the Gill man walks in, and you'll see a certain time on it. And then one shot later, it's like an hour or two off.
Oh.
And I think that is where... I love that guy's face.
Yeah, I do.
There you go. It's almost 11.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's after 2 o'clock.
Oh, yeah.
It's after 2, yeah.
And I think that's where the sprinkler mishap came in.
Oh.
I think that caused that delay.
Oh.
So that's probably the real clock up there. And here is Tom Hennessy and Ginger Stanley going into the St. John's River.
Yeah.
Followed by Agar. And all three got carried away by the current. John Agar had a little bit of a hard time
getting back.
Ginger Stanley, Rico, swam out and rescued her. Mm-hmm. And Tom Hennessy just got swept away.
Wow.
Oh, who's that? That's
That's Loretta.
Right, that's Loretta Agar.
Sure is, yeah.
Yeah, John Agar's wife.
Now, this music that's playing right here, by the way, is from Ghost of Frankenstein that Hans Salter wrote. So this is another one of your things where you use the...
always reusing.
Oh, yeah, all the time. You know, uh-huh. It becomes library music, and they just recycled it. But it fits well. I mean, it always works well in these films.
Mm-hmm. This river was all full of riptides and undertows, and I'm happy for your sake to be able to say, Laurie, they didn't make you get in it.
Mm-hmm.
That scene with the gong buoy was shot at Universal on the process stage.
Right.
And Tom Hennessy just got swept away, and I don't know why, but he still had the weights in his suit. And would you explain, Bob, why he had to have weights in his suit for certain scenes?
Well, that's to keep him from floating up to the surface, because that suit is sort of buoyant in mm-hmm. a way, and it's like divers have to use weights and stuff to hold themselves down. So that's to hold him down a little bit.
Right.
This type of thing isn't going to help him at all.
No.
If he's being swept.
They throw him in, they have him jump into a river with an undertow, but they leave the weights in
his
suit.
That's not very good. That's not smart. Yeah.
So he got swept away and came up once, and there was nobody around, complete black, and he got some air and couldn't stay on the top anymore and went under again. And guy was in Creature from the Black Lagoon. He's one of the scientists mm-hmm. at the very first scene in the scene at Brazil.
Well, they did rescue Tom Hennessy, though, because he's still around.
Yes,
right?
They sure did. But he came up twice. He was just about to go down for the third time, and a couple of guys in a boat, not even connected with the movie, heard him yelling, and they came over and they pulled him into the boat. And he says if they hadn't, he's not sure he'd be around.
That's true.
Right. And of course, he.
Here's our disrobing newscaster. Down to the shirt now. One more time, we're in trouble.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Sensors are going to stop in here.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned sensors. So Hennessy goes back to the lobster house thinking that everybody's going to be looking for him, and there's going to be great commotion. He's coming back to tell them he's okay, and they're having a party, and Jack Arnold is dancing with the girls, and he just got swept away, and nobody did anything about it.
Oh, poor guy.
There's Brett Halsey.
There's Brett Halsey, yeah.
That's him.
One of the contract players at Universal.
Yep.
And a stuntman, an actor stuntman named Robert Hoy is driving the car.
Uh-huh.
Now, there's something interesting that happens here where they stop and he gets his flashlight. Now, when he has the flashlight on, watch and you'll notice that the actual beam from his light is coming from the other side of the screen. Why they didn't have somebody on his side doing it, I don't know. But watch this. You can see, all right, there's the light. There it is. It comes in from the other side. Now, how in the world that happened, I'm not real sure. But they defied the laws of something or another.
I wish I had that flashlight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that always, I mean, when I first saw the film, I even noticed that thing.
That's funny.
What's going on here? And there's a scene coming up here in a minute. That's one of my favorite scenes in the film as far as an action thing. And that's where this guy gets thrown against the tree. And just the way it's done,
He was obviously on wires and rigged, but boy, it shows you how powerful this creature is. Here we go. This is really something.
Yeah, I remember that scene.
Oh, yeah. Oh, brother. I hope they had some foam rubber on that tree.
That's... I hope so, too.
They swung him on wires from a crane,
mm-hmm.
And one of the guys on the AOL horror boards mentioned once the creature's killer fastball, the way the guy goes down and then up again before he hits.
Curveball. Yeah,
unbelievable. I'm sorry, curveball.
Curveball. He did a great job. Yeah, curveball.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great scene, though. I mean, it makes that creature look so powerful at that point.
It is incorrect. The Gill Man has not been sighted in that
actually,
area.
Speaking of sensors, I've got some censorship information here, but I've also got, which I think is interesting, a letter that was written to the Cleveland Press and published in the Cleveland Press newspaper, August 7, 1955, from Rose Binkovitz. We all admit television is a great medium of education for young children, but why let it scare them so? For the past week, the Hippodrome Theater has been advertising Revenge of the Creature quite a few times during the day. My baby ran away from the television into the kitchen crying, and the little girl keeps asking all kinds of questions why the creature does such horrible things. There must be a better way of advertising besides frightening young children half to death, isn't there?
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Are you properly chagrined, Laurie, for being...
Give us a break.
Wow, come on. Change the channel. Change the channel.
Oh, gee. If they were around today.
Oh, that little Binkovitz girl is just screwed if she's still around.
Yeah, that's a little tame by today's standards, I'm afraid.
You're not kidding.
Now, the big question I got to ask you, Laurie, is you go on that boat with John Agar and the creature shows up, and you go to the motel and the creature shows up, and you go to the lobster house and the creature shows up. How was the creature able to stay on your tail, even though he's an underwater creature?
Well, I'll tell you what my husband... tells me whenever we're watching television. I criticize the authenticity of something that's going on in one of the movies,
mm-hmm.
and my husband says, it's only the movies, you know. I mean, it's not real life, mm-hmm. not really. It's only the movies.
Yeah, I hate to tell you that, Tom. Under the assumption that this is all true. Sorry, fella.
I've been trying to interview the Gill Man for years.
Yeah, it's only the movies, Tom. All it right. only happens
That's
in the movies.
It.
Speaking of your husband, you are married to Joe Reiner?
Joe Reiner.
And you met him when, and what's his
Well,
story?
It's been 21 years. Actually, we knew each other 3 years before we got married, and we've been married for 21 years.
Wow.
And he's retired LAPD.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a cop in New York City before that.
Right. And he goes along with you to the various conventions. And
yes, he's retired. I think he's retired the third time.
Oh, first two didn't take.
He can't keep out of trouble.
Uh-huh.
And, we travel quite a bit, and we go to the poster shows. And
then also travel, I would assume, not connected with poster shows and movies, et cetera.
And we spend a lot of time with our kids and grandkids.
Mm-hmm.
Between us, we have 4 kids and 7 grandkids.
Wow. Excellent, like the Brady Bunch.
And one sort of adopted kid.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So, they keep us busy.
Mm-hmm. I would think so. And you stopped acting when? In the late 50s?
Mm-hmm.
And you dropped out of the acting, why?
Well, actually, no, it was closer to during the 60s, because I was doing a lot of television then, and that went on up into the 60s. But then I met and married Johnny Mann of the Johnny Mann Singers.
Right.
And I quit the business and had my 2 daughters, mm-hmm. Jennifer and Susie. And so I never really went back to acting.
Did you want to go back at any point? Did you?
Not while I was raising my kids. Then we divorced when my girls were 4 and 7. So I spent my time raising my kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I really didn't go back to it. I think I did 1 or 2 television shows after that, and then just never did really
right.
do
And then
more.
Also some stage work, not all that long ago.
I did some stage, some theater stuff.
Mm-hmm. Such as?
I did The Pleasure of His Company, and Who Was That Lady I Saw You With, and a couple of other local theater things.
Mm-hmm. Is it fun to still have your hand in it a little bit?
Well, not anymore.
Not anymore?
Yeah.
Not tempted
anymore.
At all anymore?
No.
Wow.
I'm happy to just be with my kids and my husband and my grandkids.
Mm-hmm. And doing the conventions and meeting some of your old cronies there.
Yeah, and reminiscing,
enough.
Yeah.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
sure.
Yeah, meeting some of the people that I used to
Well, you found out how many thousands of fans you have.
Yeah.
With all
yeah,
the shows
a,
and stuff.
A few.
Oh, I'd say a few, yes.
Yeah. Never dreamed when I was working all those years that there would be so many people that would remember me.
Oh. Believe me, you just don't know.
Hold it! Joe, turn that light back. I think I saw something.
Anything to make you happy, man.
That's an actor named Don C. Harvey, who was the villain in a lot of movies and serials. And next to him, on the right, is a guy named Bob Welling, who later wrote the movie EGAH, which, as a matter of fact, is also a little bit of a King Kong
sort of
takeoff, just the way this movie is. Speaking of the censors, as we were a moment ago, the censor wrote to Universal after they reviewed the script, "The killings by the monster are not being considered a crime in this picture." So the monster was off the hook. That sort of eased things up. Also, in India, they made two cuts. Would you care to guess what they were, Bob?
That'd be hard to...
Hard
to guess.
Laurie Nelson. In India, they objected to you, Laurie. Bathing costume scene in Reel 5.
Of course.
One cut, 13 feet.
Oh, my goodness.
Reel 6, one cut, 18 feet. Laurie Nelson in low-cut bodice. And on. India.
You can't have that in India. No way.
No.
Can't
well,
do that.
Well, women are covered over in all of those draperies.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Years ago, I used to know Linda Sterling, who did a lot of Republic serials and Republic films, as far as that goes. And she just sort of quit when she was ahead, so to speak, too. She had two boys, she was happily married, and she just quit the business. I mean, just said, that's it, I've done all I need to do, and I don't really want to do anymore. And she never regretted it, and in fact, she ended up teaching at Glendale JC for a while. And then she just finally totally retired, and she never looked back. She said, I've done all I wanted to do, and she said, I'm extremely happy, and she's a lot happier than a lot of people I know in this business.
Well, that's kind of what happened to me. I met Johnny Mann of the Johnny Mann Singers and got married and had my two daughters. And unfortunately, we divorced when they were 4 and 7. But I quit the business when I got married, and I decided I was going to be a wife and a mother and raise my kids, and that's what I did. And I really have never looked back or regretted the fact that I didn't stay in show business and didn't continue to do movies and television, because I feel like I'm a lot happier that I didn't just hang in there and beat a dead horse to death, and I stopped when I was on top.
Very smart.
And the final King Kong connection I wanted to mention in the early drafts of the script.
Yeah.
Creature is shot to death out of a helicopter.
Oh, geez.
Just like the biplanes getting King Kong.
Yeah. Now, here's the same shot from the original ending of the first film.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know if he's really dead yet or not, because you didn't know he was dead in the original film.
Mm-hmm. And the same music from the end of the first
movie.
That's
right, exactly.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Laurie and Bob, for joining me today.
Hey, it's been fun. Loved it.
Well, thank you. It was fun.
Indeed.